Good morning.
You're out of luck.
I'd like to call to order the October business meeting of the Commonwealth Transportation Board. Yesterday was an extremely eventful day for a variety of reasons, and gosh, the audience is so much smaller. What I would like to do, as is our custom, is to begin with public comment. Is there anyone who would like to address the board under the public comment session? Mr. Southard, you've raised your hand. For those of you who don't know, Jeff Southard is the Chief Executive Officer for the Virginia Transportation Construction Alliance and represents so many of our important private partners, because when we talk about on time, on budget, it's the private sector that delivers those projects on time and on budget. Welcome, Mr. Southard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate the opportunity to be back at this podium in a somewhat different capacity than the last time I was here, I think about 3.5 years ago. I just wish it was to share some happier and more positive remarks, but frankly, after yesterday, I think all of us should have tremendous concerns. And I just want to start off making a few general comments about sort of the financial situation and the political situation that goes along with that financial situation, because frankly, I feel perfectly comfortable making those comments and calling the situation as I see it. You know, for 8 years, most of us in this room have advocated long-term sustainable funding for transportation. We've warned about the problems. We've warned that the issue was going to turn bad. We went through the Gilmore Commission that recommended looking at new funding. We went through V-Trans that showed the General Assembly what the needs were in Virginia. We went through the START Commission, and they talked about all the funding that was needed. We've had special sessions after special sessions to try to address transportation funding. And as my grandfather used to say, those chickens have finally come home to roost. Mr. McCarthy talked yesterday about when he came on the board with a transportation program that exceeded, a six-year program that exceeded $10 billion. It's amazing to think that 6 years later, with the cost of delivering those projects, how much we've seen that program drop. And in my opinion, and we saw some indications of that yesterday, it will continue to drop until the General Assembly heeds the warning that we've given for 8 years that we were going to have this kind of situation if we didn't do something to ensure there was long-term sustainable funding for transportation. Yesterday was just the 5,000-foot view. We heard the big numbers. And I think, as Mrs. Connolly said, they were just staggering. They're particularly staggering thinking about, I think, 600 projects that were cut about a year ago to 2 years ago, going through this again. When we get down to about 500 feet a month from now, when you see the draft six-year program, I think it will send a shockwave through all corners of the Commonwealth. I was raised in Fairfax County, nice little quaint community at that time. And I was looking at some numbers the other night that Fairfax County in 1996 for its local roads got $28 million. 1996. 2008, we got $26 million. Some pretty smart people in this room that can take the cost of inflation and the present day value. In 2009, it was $13 million. And my guess is when you see the six-year program, Fairfax County might be looking at $8 million for their local road program, compared to $28 million in 1996. So when we see that flesh put on the bones when the strategic program comes out, this is going to be, I think, devastating. And my hope is it will be a wake-up call to those people responsible for making those decisions about adequately funding transportation. And as we see that six-year program unveiled next month, we're going to see things like we've never seen before. Levels of service decrease. Tucker talked yesterday about the transit opportunities and the rail opportunities decreasing. It's hard to imagine in Northern Virginia and Hampton Roads and even Richmond that people may have to be turned away because we don't have adequate funding to support the transit and rail operations that they rely on. We'll see positions cut at VDOT, and VDOT will be at its lowest employment level in, if anybody can remember, back when it was that low. We'll see quality of our roadways decrease. We'll see congestion increase. We'll see greater inconvenience for the traveling public, and all of that will get unveiled over the next few months. So yesterday we heard the bad news from 5,000 feet. Unfortunately, I think in the next 60 days we'll see the bad news right up front. But that's the world we live in. That's the decision that the legislature has made, that VDOT will have to operate, and DRPT and ports and aviation and DMV will have to operate within those means that they currently have. And so to that end, I want to applaud the commissioner, secretary, and all the senior staff who have worked diligently over the last couple of months to try to make this something that we can do the best we can with the limited resources that we have. And for my folks, VTCA represents 350 corporations in Virginia that design, build, supply the road construction and maintenance activities in Virginia. As you can imagine, it's going to be devastating for our people. Over the last couple of weeks, I've talked to a handful of senior management from small companies to medium-sized companies to large companies, and it's ranged from, we're just going to batten down the hatches and hold on tight and hope we can survive, to companies who have said we're moving a substantial part of our operations out of Virginia, to companies who have said in 6 months we're going to be out of business. And that's just what it means for these folks. And it means facilities closing, companies going out of business, employees being laid off. But again, that's the hand we've been dealt. That's the world we live in. What we realize is that one of the most effective ways to try to make those construction and maintenance dollars go as far as they can is to look at ways for VDOT and our members to deliver projects cheaper. Not necessarily the on time and on budget part, and that partnership is a real example of how state agencies and the private sector can work together. And we've all seen how tremendous those numbers have moved up in the last 5 years. We're working with VDOT. We've been able to deliver projects on time and on budget in a way that I think would rival any DOT in the nation. Now it's looking at what can we do to reduce costs? What can we do that makes it cheaper for VDOT to deliver projects and cheaper for VTCA members to deliver projects? That doesn't put more money on the bottom line, but it means that little bit of money that you have hopefully can go farther. And we started some discussions, frankly, a couple of months ago, and have actually implemented at least one thing that I can that I'm aware of, and that was the ability for contractors to purchase steel for projects in advance of when that steel would actually be used. The downside for VDOT is they have to pay for it then, and the contractor's got to store it. But it means the steel is bought at a price certain and can be stored, and we don't have to worry about market fluctuations and those kinds of things. So it creates a little bit of a cash issue for VDOT, but it ensures that we can get the project delivered on time and on budget. Several weeks ago, about 20 of our members met with the commissioner, chief engineer, chief operations, and the chief financial officer to start some more in-depth discussions about things we could do and put everything on the table. As the commissioner said yesterday, he's been very open about, let's not be shy, let's put it on the table. We may not be able to move it anywhere, but let's get it on the table. And there are things that mean that the traveling public would be inconvenienced in the delivery of certain projects. But by inconveniencing them, it might allow us to save more time. It means that we may have to go to alternative materials that may not be of the quality that we would like to use on certain projects, but will allow us to do more work with the limited resources we have. Let me give you an example that we talked about. Take a piece of rural interstate highway, apply probably to urban as well. right now so as to minimize any inconvenience to the crowd and the public. That work is done at night. And that work usually doesn't start till 9 o'clock. Traffic control crews get out there. You've got to mobilize the operation, and then you've got to start taking it all back down at 4 o'clock in the morning. That is the right way to do a project if you want to make sure that traffic continues to flow and the traveling public's inconvenienced. But suppose we said, we're going to run this 24/7. Traveling public's going to be inconvenienced. We'll do everything we can to inform of that through 511. We'll do everything we can to inform of that through local media, variable message signs. But we're going to do that paving project 24/7. We'll try to keep one lane open. We may have to divert traffic. The example that one of our members gave was a paving project that might include, say, 5 miles of interstate, rural interstate. Working restricted hours at night takes 10 days. If they could run it 24/7, they'd be in and out in 72 hours. At a cost savings, probably about 20%. The bad news is the traffic would be backed up, people would be inconvenienced, but that's something that we have to start looking at. Same thing with the materials that we use, whether it be certain grades of asphalt, paperwork, the EVA requirements that cost VDOT and the contractors tens of thousands of dollars a year. So I want to thank the commissioner and thank his senior staff for engaging in this. The commissioner is meeting with our folks again, I think in 2 weeks, to continue those discussions about things that we think we can do now. Again, not so much to add money to the bottom line, but to look at alternative ways of delivering projects that may make that money go farther than it is. So, Commissioner, again, thank you. Mr. Secretary, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to address you all. And, of course, Mr. Chairman, if there's any questions, I'd be glad to answer.
Mr. Dickens, after you, sir.
Thank you very much, sir. And I apologize for leaving the room. My 90-year-old mother was missing in action. She was getting her hair fixed, so we found her. But I do apologize.
Very important for that.
Yeah. I think your suggestions about looking at alternative issues are really, really important in the time frame that we have now, particularly if there's savings involved, and maybe we start being less concerned about time in traffic as opposed to getting a 72-hour project done with a 20% savings. And so forth. I think that's great. I do have one question for you. I think I've heard you say at some point in time that $1 billion invested in infrastructure generates X number of jobs. Is that your number?
$1 billion invested in transportation generates between 32,000 and 37,000 jobs, depending upon the nature of the work. And more importantly, it has an economic multiplier of 2.2. So if the Commonwealth invests $1 billion in transportation, it generates $2.2 billion worth of economic activity throughout the Commonwealth. So, in a time when the economy's down, if you really want to stimulate it, you can send everybody $500 checks, where we can make investments in our infrastructure. That was the point I wanted to make.
Mr. Sutton, thank you for your time. Thank you for our longstanding partnership, and it's good to see you back behind the podium.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Would anybody else like to address the board before we go into the business agenda? If not, is there a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved. Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Action item one is a comprehensive listing of abandonances, discontinuances, and transfers in the primary and the secondary system of state highways. Are there any questions of Ms. Sorrell? Is there a second? All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you. Page 4 of your printed agenda under the Local Assistance Division. You've had a presentation previously on the FY09 revenue sharing program. Are there questions of Mr. Estes? And I know, Mr. Estes, this will be a brief business meeting. You may want to wait here just in case there are some individual project questions that sometimes come up as a consequence of that.
One quick question,
Mr. Sterling.
presentation, you have indicated that all localities, all projects that were requested or submitted were indeed funded. Is that the case?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Sterling, if I could maybe spend just a minute on the funding situation. As the funding currently stands, the full $50 million, that would be $15 million in state funds and $35 million in bond funding from House Bill 3202 a couple years ago. We can fund all the requests that we have. If you'll notice in the resolution that we're asking the board to approve, we've added a stipulation that says that it's subject to the availability of funding sufficient to fully fund all the allocations. So what we're going to plan to do is ask the board today to approve this resolution, but we're going to put ourselves in a little bit of a holding pattern before we release that money to make sure we know exactly that we have all that $50 million available. And once we do that, we're in a position that we can immediately then let the localities know that we can move forward.
And I might add, the $35 million in bond funds have been tied up in litigation. There was a lawsuit filed well over a year ago by Mr. McSweeney. A number of individuals whose names will be familiar to you have funded this lawsuit. It has tied up the issuance of these bonds that support our rail program, that support the local revenue sharing program. It was just heard in Richmond Circuit Court last week. Last month. We did get a decision last week, an affirmative and positive decision. However, the plaintiffs have an opportunity to appeal until tomorrow. If they appeal, it goes to the Supreme Court on an expedited basis, but again, the issuance of those bonds would be held up until that all of that litigation is finally resolved, and that would not be until at some time next year.
If that litigation is resolved and the Commonwealth is successful, we still got a budget issue that is out there. How much of the $50 million that would be coming from the state, whether 15 to 35, would be at risk as a result of what we're currently looking at? Do we know as yet?
For the current year, we are anticipating committing the entire $35 million towards this, but we have to. In future years, that's anybody's guess.
So this one is basically, we're on hold due to the litigation, but if the litigation is resolved successfully on our behalf, then this is the list.
That's correct. But I would say, as we talked about yesterday,
anything can happen.
It's a $3 billion bond. The first draw is for matching to match federal dollars. The second draw is to match local dollars through the revenue sharing program. And the third, if anything is left over, is to for priority projects. There are set-asides for rail capital, for transit capital, for the local revenue sharing program. And again, so important to match federal dollars. We are under a mandate to match federal dollars, which is a good thing, but those come off the top. To the degree that these bond funds are not available to match federal funds, we have to reach in and take it out of the formula distributions across all modes, and that's going to present some very serious challenges.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. White,
does this resolution, Mike, address the possibility that if there is an appeal, that there will be a partial release of funds, or is the entire fund to be held up until the resolution of that case?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. White, good question. Our intent right now is that we're gonna hold those funds in entirety until we get resolution, because I remind the board of the tier levels that are in the code. If we get less than the amount that's requested, we're gonna have to go to those tier levels and then prorate the application. So if something happens with that litigation where there's less than the $50 million or less than the amount requested, we'll have to come back to the board with another resolution, another list for approval.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, move the approval.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Action item 3A is recreational access in Pulaski County. Is there a motion?
I move approval. Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Action item 3B is a recreational access grant for the city of Pocosin. Is there a motion?
Approval. Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Action item four is a transfer of transportation enhancement funds from the city of Martinsville to Henry County. Are there any questions of Mr. Estes while this issue is before us? Is there a motion?
I move approval. Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Action item five, under right-of-way division, Ms. Corder is here to answer any questions. 5A in Halifax County.
I move approval.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Action item 5B is in Caroline County.
I move approval.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
And action item 6 is a limited access control change and land conveyance in Hanover County. Have we previously had a presentation on this? Oh, is this just the an extension?
I'm not sure. This is a resubmission of an item that was approved in 2006. It has come back to us because the requester had not followed through on the purchase of the property and has also asked for minor changes in the area. The original area was 0.78 acres and he's now requesting 0.927.
This is valuable property and we have encouraged the department to seek the maximum return on our investment in this property. So with that, I would move approval.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you. Mr. Craig Allen is here to answer any questions on the six-year program transfers. Are there any questions of Mr. Allen? Is there a motion? All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you, Mr. Allen. And I would say, as we descend into the financial straits that we're heading into, this action item will become increasingly important as we have to keep projects alive in a very, very tight scenario. I think we'll be seeing on a monthly basis probably more aggressive transfers, and some of those transfers will be more painful than what we have been experiencing in the past. Action item 8 under the Department of Rail and Public Transportation, Mr. Corey Hill is here to talk about the special allocation regarding the new Freedom. We did have a presentation at last month's work sessions. Are there any questions of Mr. Hill? Is there a motion?
Move approval.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Action item 9 is on the transit sustainability and investment policy. Are there questions of Mr. Hill or Mr. Tucker? And I would say, Mr. Tucker, I know this started out as a very contentious issue. Probably we'll come back to us yet again as our resources tighten. In effect, this is requiring certain floors on local contributions to transit and recognizing that as they face diminishing revenues. This policy may need to be revisited, whether up or down. This is a very challenging relationship as to if the Commonwealth is putting additional investments into transit to expect a comparable level of support out of the localities. And you may want to add some additional comments.
Yeah,
Mr.
and
Tucker.
I think what's really timely, because I think back in the summer we had originally brought this item to the board as a briefing discussion. It grew out of budget bill language in 2008 that asked DRPT to implement principles of asset management, sustainability, and public benefit evaluation in our transit program, similar to what we do in our rail enhancement fund program. And it's a big step for the organization. If you recall back in 2006 when I came on board, I said the agency sort of had the history of being an ATM machine for folks, and now we were more so focused on public benefits, and our programs have grown very dramatically. I think it's very timely considering what we talked about yesterday and that we're going to have to set priorities. What we talk about in this document is really laying out a policy framework for the CTB that looks at not only when we make additional investments related to operating money that we expect the local government to continue to do their fair share, but we also talk about major new investments. And one of the key items for us is that when we look at major new investments, whether it be a new Dodge light rail project or heavy rail, inner city rail, or new bus system, we have to really understand it from, is it the appropriate mode, and for us as a CTB, understanding what are the long-term capital and operating costs associated with what bringing that service online. And it gives us much better information, I think, up front than what we've had before in terms of just allowing projects to come in a program, even when we may not have sufficient funds to support the cost of new projects. So really this covers both capital and operating. The plan clearly contemplates that over time that we may have to have independent judgment and discretion from a CTB perspective to deal with certain issues that we can't contemplate today.
Mr. Sterling.
Mr. Chairman, on this, what would be, when we're looking at in terms of local commitments and that they would be funding, whether capital or operating, what are we looking at for a floor?
Well, we have a two-step process, and I would just mention that we did have extensive outreach with stakeholders on the implementation of policy. But it's a two-tier process. The first tier of the process was, are you operating the same number of train miles or bus miles as you operated the previous fiscal year? That's fairly straightforward. So if you're doing what you did last year and new state funds come in, you're fine. Let's say for whatever reason that changed. Then we go to the next step and we look at from a local contribution perspective. That could be your local general fund revenue and your customer revenue to see if that is commensurate to the level that you had in the previous year. And if that were the same or more, you would be eligible for the full state allocation under those scenarios. Now, as an example, we did a look at this for fiscal year 09 allocations, and I think we might have had, was it maybe one or two transit systems that would not have met that criteria. But what's important to note that they still got what received more operating money than they would have the previous fiscal year, just not the maximum amount of operating money for which they could have been eligible if they had maintained that level of effort.
So we wouldn't necessarily be mandating increased payments on the part of the locality. And the reason I bring this up is in some cases there's growing frustration that communities or localities that participate in certain mass transit programs, VRE is a good example, they participate, people from surrounding communities that don't participate go there, and then the communities that do participate have to pay essentially the subsidy, and they're paying the costs associated with that. And does this envision any way in which somehow that cost gets shared of these non-participating communities, that we somehow can take that off of the communities that are participating?
Well, I guess, let me
say... That's a nice diplomatic way of saying...
And I'll
segregate
the
this?
Issues, because clearly what the policy intent here is, if the General Assembly increases funding for transit to a specific locality, it's not the intent for that locality to stop doing what they were doing today and reprogram those dollars somewhere else. That's all this program is trying to address, is to make sure that the investments that we make in transit are additive. The issue that you're speaking of is a larger issue, and I'll punt that issue over to the chair, because I think from a policy point of view, I've worked here in transit in Virginia. I've worked at Greater Richmond Transit Company, and one of the bigger dilemmas was that our transit service, that most of the people who needed the bus service lived in the urbanized area, and most of the jobs were located out in the suburban localities, and there was really no requirement or mandate that the adjoining communities participate in the program, even though it provided a public benefit going in both directions. And it's a larger planning issue that I think the Commonwealth needs to look at.
And that's where I'm concerned. I mean, this is a very important service that gets provided, but there's a growing disconnect between the cost and the value as it associates those who are member or participating communities versus those who aren't. And as that disconnect grows, the system is in jeopardy. And so I just hope there's some way that we can, whether it's a General Assembly or others, can come to grips with that and reach a solution that will address this for the long term.
I remember we had the conversation relative to the rail program, and I think that's something we've talked about internally. It's a very real issue, and I think part of it, I know, Secretary, you and I, we've had discussions and meetings on this issue, And some of these decisions happen at MPOs. And these decisions occur there, and really we're not really part of the process. But I do think in terms of the steps that you all have made and investments you've made and things you've asked us to do as an agency, that we're going to be in a better position with information for the CTB to look at. Because I think as we try to balance what we want to do with our transit and rail programs, we are going to have to deal with the issue of connectivity and how do we equitably distribute benefits and costs.
Yeah.
I'm with you on that.
I would only add in that this is precisely why the Commonwealth participates in transit systems. And the largest single contributor to VRE is the Commonwealth, is to shoulder its share of the burden. And we don't talk a lot about that, but I think if we were to look at, and the two most immediate examples, and this is more true on rail than on the bus side, of VRE, you know, those jurisdictions have been granted some additional local taxing power to help defray those costs that is not enjoyed by other jurisdictions. And in those cases, and this is true of Metro as well as VRE, if you parse the numbers, the Commonwealth is by far the largest single contributor to those systems. And one of the things that we have found, and this policy that we're contemplating approving here, is that there have been instances where, as the Commonwealth has increased its funding, the localities have decreased theirs. Now, I know that's not true of the Metro jurisdictions. That is actually true of some VRE jurisdictions. And outside of those regions where there is a regional rail system, that is predominantly true. And so this is a very, very substantial policy change, and it comes at a tough time for localities. But if we are going to have a balance between, and we have a very similar debate with respect to land use, we can no longer afford to have a locality making decisions that is imposing essentially unbridled costs on the Commonwealth. And so whether it's the transportation impact analysis, which was so valuable in the case of Loudoun County, or the BRAC relocations in Fairfax County, or this policy here on essentially a maintenance of effort has a particular impact in Hampton Roads localities, it's very, very important. And this is, again, not easily accessible. If you think about where we are, we have this difficult, challenging partnership. Now, you say, well, if I'm not part of VRE or Metro, why do I care about this? I'll tell you why. We are looking at passenger rail extensions in the I-81 and the 95 corridor, the 29 corridor specifically. Well, here's the question. Should localities participate in the operational costs? And the question of equity, probably most of you have been lobbied on this issue. Should we provide for free to, for example, the city of Lynchburg, something that Stafford County or Prince William or the city of Manassas or the city of Fredericksburg is paying for with their commuter rail, when those are essentially morning trips and we're trying to make it about jobs and school as we are. It's not commuter rail, it's intercity rail. But that raises very profound questions about what is the participation of localities in the provision of these regional rail and transit services. This is going to be one of the thorniest questions over the next several months, and it's occurring in an environment of diminishing resources. So it's very, very important, and thank you for asking that question.
Just one, if I understood from the discussion, what this is it still allows flexibility whether a local community provides that through, whether it's a direct payment or fare payments.
Absolutely.
That mix is still essentially up to the jurisdiction or jurisdictions that participate. Okay.
Absolutely.
Any other questions or comments?
Yes.
Ms. Carr.
And I understand where Mr. Sterling is coming from. I really do. Suppose that a jurisdiction said, okay, if you're not participating in VRE, so therefore we cannot, your ridership would be diminished. What would happen if those passengers who are riding VRE now did not have the ability to ride as far as funding? I mean, you got thousands of people who are on the VRE that maybe the locality does not participate in VRE. And those citizens are riding, are passengers of the VRE. And, of course, they pay their fee. And they were not allowed to ride the VRE, and that would be a decrease then, of course, in the ridership.
Well, but you would have an increase in vehicles on the road, and in your case, I-95. We're trying to take cars off of I-95. But, you know, in the early days of establishing VRE, where parking lots were a local responsibility, some jurisdictions tried to do precisely that, saying if you're from our city, you got to have, you know, a decal from our city to get in the parking lot. Well, you can't do that. You can't do that. And public transportation is like a public library or a public highway. It is open public access. And it is both illegal and immoral to try and pick and choose winners and losers in that debate. And again, I come back to and this, that is why the Commonwealth is the largest single contributor. It is not a necessarily a majority of funding, but the largest single public sector contribution comes from the Commonwealth is in recognition of that fact.
Well, I just asked that question because I am very concerned of how that the localities who are not participating, how do we get them, how do we put in words, in action, so they will understand how important it is to participate.
Mm-hmm. Well, your home jurisdiction, Spotsylvania County, has been trying, some members of that board have been trying to join VRE, and it's been a struggle. My observation, again, based on history, is that in some respects, we have outgrown the organizational structure that was necessary to get VRE started. And we have to look at perhaps different forms of organization to allow that service to grow organically. And this is also happening again in this environment. Probably the single biggest driver is liability in rail. In Los Angeles, last month there were 25 people killed. And so that drives the insurance industry. That has enormous costs and implications for the provision of transit services, particularly when you're on a mixed right-of-way with freight, as we have on VRE. And so Mr. Tucker and I and Secretary of Finance, the Division of Risk Management, we've had extensive and very difficult conversations about liability issues that have not been completely addressed. I think in the Hampton Roads area, with the advent of the Norfolk Light Rail and very keen interest both in Portsmouth and Virginia Beach on both sides of Norfolk wanting to join that, we have an opportunity, hopefully, to do something that is a little more expansive in terms of an organizational structure and can allow, you know, we need to think ahead, not just what does it take for the politics to get a service up and running, but to have an organizational structure that fosters growth and doesn't create the kind of tensions between neighboring jurisdictions that we have right now. It's a very extreme challenge, and it raises enormously expensive and difficult questions. We may, Ms. Tucker, we probably would need to, I think, schedule some time, you know, on this very issue. I think there's, as we look at, you know, if you look at the governor's transportation package in the special session, probably the most important part of that got very little airplay, the Transportation Change Fund. And that was trying to do a couple of things. Transit, rail, economic development. And putting those things, you know, in putting hard dollars behind those and doing it in a way that encouraged better land uses and recognized, you know, the energy environment. We will be making more of these investments, but we may, just as we're learning today with highways, we can't afford to maintain what we already have. We have to set up a structure that does not create long-term liabilities that we can't afford. And, you know, I can think of, there are just two great real-world examples trying to extend BRE. And that discussion, I wish Mr. Schwartz was here. That discussion has been going on for 15 years to try and get BRE out to Fauquier or south of Fredericksburg into Spotsylvania. Very tough. Sorry to bore you all, but it's a very important issue. Any questions of Mr. Hill and Mr. Tucker? Is there a motion?
Move.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
All right. The policy decision, we had a briefing yesterday by Mr. Walton. The model public participation guidance, and this is just for regulations. This does not affect project development or the six-year program.
Move approval.
Second.
All in favor?
Mr. Chairman, if I could beg your indulgence a second. Mm-hmm. I have in the audience today, I know a lot of you have probably been going through WAMAC withdrawals since Stewart retired as the director of State Right-of-Way. We do have a new director of State Right-of-Way. I'd like to introduce him, Richard Bennett. Richard joined us in September, and I want you all to get to know him because I'm sure he'll work with you in the future. Thanks so much, Mr. Chairman.
We would like Richard to welcome you back on behalf of the Commonwealth Transportation Board. For those of you who don't know Mr. Bennett, he did serve in the Right-of-Way Division for a number of years, and he's had a taste of the private sector, so hopefully you've learned some of the playbook tricks over there you can bring to our side of the table. Real estate, as the Commissioner can attest, is probably the most difficult thing we deal with in transportation. Very, very difficult, so welcome. All right, Mr. Coburn. Is this a good month or a bad month?
Good morning. We've got, always it's good news to be on this side of the grass, sir, but we have mixed blessings, and we have mixed news as it comes from the standpoint of interest in our bidders. For the last several months, as an example, we're getting an increase in new firms wanting to become pre-qualified. Some are established firms working in the commercial and private industry in Virginia. Some are firms coming into Virginia from other states, which appear to be expanding into multiple states looking for business. That's sort of a blessing. We've got more interest, but they're looking at us because they don't have work elsewhere. All that said, we are seeing some of the common commodities that are common to a lot of our products still with upward pressure. Commodities that are very fuel sensitive or very unstable. And folks in my shop are scratching their head and certainly doing a bit more analysis as we're trying to present information to you. That said, we're presenting four projects to you of the 19 that were opened in September. We've received over four bids per project. That's up, it was almost 4.5 bidders per project. That's up from right at four. So interest is increasing. Of the four that we're presenting, if perhaps we can take them one at a time.
Page one.
Page one is interstate resurfacing project that also is federalized paving with guardrail safety and improvements. We only received one bidder, but we are recommending that for award.
But if I might,
Mr. Bowie.
I was wondering why in the world they would recommend this until Mr. Coburn explained that from the scope of work was substantially increased, which explains the difference between the six-year program amount and the bid amount. With that explanation from Mr. Coburn, I would move the approval.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Page two.
Page two, the first project is 460. This is the connector project in Buchanan County. We received five bids on this project. This project does contain sidewalks along both the existing parts of existing 460 as well as the connector in that area. We recommend its approval.
Mr. Chairman,
I'd like to add that this project is a cooperative effort on the floodproofing with the Army Corps of Engineers. As the state's 20% participation part in that overall project of some $130 million that the Corps is spending. And this is a ongoing four-laning of 460, about 460 that will put it through the town of Grundy. This is in the middle section of the town of Grundy. And, of course, it's primarily being moved forward with ARC monies. So certainly a very important project, and I want to move approval.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
The next project is on Interstate 77 in Carroll County. It's shoulder improvements, installation of rumble strips, which are, as you're aware, a safety device, and some guardrail upgrades. We received two bidders on this project and recommend its award.
Is there a motion?
Move approval.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Page three.
The last project is a combined project in the city of Fredericksburg and Spotsylvania County. Has funding sources from both of those systems. Project contains sidewalks and some landscaping items. You'll notice we received eight bidders on this project, which is, as we are in the more urbanized and northern area of the state, we are attracting an increased number of bidders. We recommend its approval.
Is there a motion?
I'll make a motion for approval, Mr. Chairman. This looks good.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you, Mr. Coburn. Does anybody have anything they want to bring up under new business? Mr. Dickens.
I have several items. Following the bid, it brings to mind a question. With the budget cycle, constraints being what they are there some things that we need to look at that are things that we would like to have as opposed to things that we want to have? It's guardrails, improving guardrails and those kinds of things. Are they things that can be, that money can be diverted into lane miles, things that are more productive?
And I'm going to get probably a better explanation from the commissioner here. But one of the consequences of injecting federal dollars into our maintenance program is they are accompanied by federal mandates. So the scope, the upgrading of guardrail, the limits of the project, all of those things are dictated by federal requirements. And this is true not only for highway but for transit and to some degree rail projects. One of the most important things we want to do with our rail enhancement fund is to not let that program become federalized because of precisely what you're seeing there. I'm sure the commissioner will want to comment as well.
Yeah, just as an enhancement over that conversation, we've opened a dialogue between the chief engineer of the Federal Highway Administration, Mr. Coburn, over the last 3 weeks about the have-to-haves versus the what we'd like to have question, not the nice-to-haves, what we'd like to have. Mr. Fonseca, our division administrator for FHWA here, has been very open. I met with him last week, and we will reach an accommodation where, as we federalize overlays, whether they're on the primary or on the secondary system, eligible portions of the secondary, or on the interstate, there will be a conscious decision about which safety features to upgrade, if any, while we're doing that work. Up till now, the general driving force has been, if you touch it with federal aid, you got to fix everything while you're there. And that's an old theory. That's the old theory that they didn't trust that we would actually go in and fix things later. We all recognize that's off the table now, and that we need to look at it differently. So I'm it'll take us a couple of months to start to filter this into the projects that you see. But the development staffs will be proposing the have-to-haves on the projects as we do this kind of work.
Okay. Thank you. In regards to the November presentation of the new six-year plan, I would like to suggest that a priority go to congestion mitigation as much as possible as you put this plan together. Building new lane miles is great, but congestion mitigation, in my opinion, is much more important at this point in time with the revenue that we have. And there's I think it's on page 12 of the budget, there's an outline of allocations to the different line items, and we're going to be changing the allocation, changing money out of the construction budget into the maintenance budget, I would assume, and this probably will impact a lot of other pieces in our budget. What I'd like to do is I'd like to see a trend, a five-year trend in that page 12, which shows the line items, which will give us
for the maintenance deficit.
Yeah, please.
Oh yeah, we have all kinds of pretty graphics we shared for 3 years with the General Assembly, so that's well trod ground. I think I've got some already printed up copies in my office.
But not only the maintenance deficit, but how it impacts the entire budget is what I mean.
Yeah, that is going to be
fun. And I appreciate that. And I want to put one more issue on the floor for discussion. There's been some discussion about the Jordan Bridge being closed in Hampton Roads and the Gilmerton Bridge being rebuilt or replaced. The Gilmerton Bridge was funded. Inflation caused a shortfall of roughly $20 million. The district suggested that shortfall be made up by moving money from a couple of different projects in the region. One of those projects had some federal money. I think about a $12 million earmark had been applied to that. And some members of the congressional delegation were in the room when the discussion to move that money took place. And they were not happy about moving money off of a project that they had worked to get an earmark on the premise that it made that project look like less of a priority, and the concern was, and I talked to Court about this yesterday, the concern was that it would make it much more difficult for them to get monies, not only in that project, but in projects around the state. If VDOT moved money off one project onto another. And understanding that we have a priority here of getting projects built, getting bridges built, and money has to come from somewhere. I wanted to get a little feedback, and Cord may want to throw some fuel in that fire.
Not at this time.
Mr. Sterling,
okay.
I'm sure.
I'm positive.
You're welcome to tread on this ground.
No. I think we need to give some thought to it and see what can be done, and I think this is something over the next couple of weeks to have more discussions and see how we can best leverage what limited funds we have.
And I think this is a very timely topic, and there really are two issues here. The first, Commissioner, I don't think it is appropriate for district staff to make public recommendations about which projects are cut. That's the responsibility of this body. And to put that out in a public arena is not the right way to do it. It set off a very incendiary debate in the Hampton Roads region. And the reality is every project they're talking about, when they see the draft or the December, November revised six-year program, they're taking money from projects that probably won't even be there. It is a moot discussion. And so I would say to all of you, and particularly the district representatives, Assuming there's a level of certainty and predictability about what projects are in fact funded today or not only gets you into trouble. And what we need to do is to allow the staff to work through and see, okay, how much money do we actually have? What does it take to get a Gilmerton Bridge project? And we'll get those, that goes out to bid, I believe, in January or February. By spring, we may need more money when those bids. We saw that today in a couple of bids. The scope could change. Commodity prices could soar. And so when we establish a priority and when we get close to construction, and that's what we're about in this last go-round in June, which is to find those projects that can go to bid, we're going to bring them to bid, and whatever it takes to make up the difference, that is our responsibility for both highways, transit, and rail projects. The second thing, again, for this body, congressional earmarks, you know, we work very carefully with our legislative delegation to suggest which projects are appropriate for congressional earmarks and which not. And we have, for example, Bland Avenue Interchange, about $40 million. We left on the table about 25 of $40 million that was accumulated over the years by two successive congressmen for an interchange that the Federal Highways would never approve. Now the money went away and then Federal Highways said, well, now we're willing to approve it, but it's a very different interchange and it no longer meets the needs of the city. And this is one of the challenges in the earmarking process, and in the instance, Mr. Dickens, that you mentioned, there is a $12 to $14 million earmark, if I remember correctly, on a $300 million project. So we ask of our congressional representatives that they consult with us, and to the degree that those designated funds are available for projects, it needs to be for projects that can actually happen. And you know, we find this issue with local governments, with regional entities, with our congressional delegation, and also private partners. I know of several districts where we've been approached, and more often than not, it's on the commercial side. I'll put $4 million towards this interchange, and that's a big deal for the private entity, but if the ultimate cost of the interchange is $50 or $60 or $70 million, it's not something that's going to happen. And we long ago abandoned that practice of putting money and effort into projects that don't have a realistic possibility of occurring. Mr. McCarthy.
Maybe a constructive suggestion in your ongoing negotiations with the representatives is to suggest something along the lines of, for example, if they really want to put any earmarks they choose to seek to good use, let's put them to work on things that they help create, such as the BRAC impact. That'd be a wonderful place to start, as I see it, because we didn't initiate that, and yet we're having to pay that bill, and it would be nice to get some federal funds of a serious nature to address those impacts because they're real, and it seems to me there's an appropriate nexus between responsibility and funding that we might want to push in that direction.
Very good suggestion, and again on that, some members of our congressional delegation are very, very good about that. You know, losing a Senator John Warner in the Senate, who has worked closely for the last three reauthorization bills and in a leadership position. You look at the projects that he has steered money towards, whether it's Wilson Bridge or safety improvements on I-81 or the Heartland Corridor, you know, those are all things that are underway and under construction. So I think some of it is a little bit of legislative seasoning as well. Mr. Sterling.
Chairman, correct me wrong, though, when we see a congressional earmark, aren't they in reality earmarking funds that otherwise were going, it's part of the state allocation. So I think I'd remind everybody, and when you're talking to your local communities and others that want to seek a federal earmark, all they're doing is earmarking funds we would have otherwise come into the system that we would have allocated based on the priorities. I know that it was always Senator Warner's practice to basically coordinate with the the governor's office to identify what were those projects rather than going out and seeking individual ones. But I think we need to keep that in mind, is the more federal earmarks you see, the less money that you're going to have to apply towards all the various priorities. And in some cases, it may go to lower priority projects for the state system than we would as a body otherwise merit.
That's a good reminder. I would say that there are many earmarks are like that, where they're simply earmarking the formula-driven money that otherwise would, you know, go through this body. But there are some which are actually new money. And for example, Wilson Bridge was all new money. The I-81 earmarks are all new money. The Heartland Corridor was all new money. Some of the other projects that we've discussed here in this conversation were simply telling us how to spend the formula allocation. So it's a delicate balance, and one that we deal with on a daily basis. Any other questions or comments under new business? Mr. Dickens, thank you for bringing up those issues. If there's nothing else, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you, and drive safely.